Yes, Michael and I are sitting here fully geared up. I did not get it. I did not. Very interesting. Yeah. 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 I don't worry about it. We'll play with it and see what happens. Okay. 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 How old are these people? When did they come? Really? Oh, okay. Yeah, because all the older people I know have long passed on. Great. So that worked out for you? Yeah. Okay. Well, the Sikhs are from the northern portion of India, from Punjab province. It used to be much larger than the current Punjab state. And they were involved for a very long time in the wars against the British. In fact, the Sikhs were the last people who were subjugated by the British in the middle of the 19th century. As a consequence of that, they were valued to join in the army, and in fact, they maintained Sikh regiments in the army for until very, very recently. And because they were part of the British Empire military, they actually went all over the world as regiments to every place that the British had colonies. And so they traveled fairly widely and got a sort of a fairly broad education. Some of them also went for economic reasons to places like to build the railway in East Africa. And they probably came to North America largely on the strength of having heard of advertisements about all the land that was available and how rich it was in Canada. And there was a Sikh regiment that came into Canada at the latter part of the century. And they saw this land in the summertime up in Vancouver, British Columbia, and thought there's hardly anybody here. The land is wonderful. The water is, great. And this might be a good place to start. And what we find is then between 1904 and 1907, you had a fairly large, about 6,500 people come in, and that was the beginning of it into North America. Yes, one of the problems was is that Punjab has always been one of the most densely populated states in India, and the farmland is finite. And if you have four brothers, let's say, the land was divided equally. It doesn't take very long, many generations, before the land becomes too small to actually farm independently. So it became very common that one or two of the youngest members of the family, males, of course, would go outside to seek their fortunes elsewhere, sometimes outside of Punjab, but within India, other times within Asia, and for some, they would go overseas. There were also a series of famines that occurred in the late 1800s in India. There was tremendous inflation in land prices. There were various health issues. There were all kinds of diseases that swept through the place. And as a result, people were looking outside for some additional opportunities, never generally expecting to stay in the countries they were going to, but simply to remit money back for a period of time to buy more land or build a bigger house or finance education for other members of the family and then to return home. Well, most of them came into the West Coast. They came largely in the beginning through Canada, and then they moved between 1904, 1907, 1908. They had moved all the way down through Washington, through Oregon, into California, and then all the way down to the Imperial Valley. The immigration essentially ended, large-scale immigration ended about 1908, 1909, and it certainly was put a complete halt to by the 1917 barred zone provision and then later on the revocation of citizenship. But it's interesting that between about 1920 and probably 1940, another 3,000 illegal immigrants came up largely through Mexico. And by shaving their beard and taking their turbans off with the dark skins, they were able to simply come across the border and nobody really noticed. And so most of those came, some of them through the Panama Canal. There were even cases of people landing in the Panama Canal, walking through Central America, and coming over the border into the United States. So a total of about 10,000 people. 10,000 Sikhs were in the United States between about 1904 and about 1955. Well, initially, many of them had Canadian Commonwealth passports, so that they were legal immigrants coming into Canada. When they came into the United States, it got a little more difficult for them. There were a number of Indians over the period of time that did apply for and receive citizenship. Some of the early Sikhs actually served in the armed forces, both in the First and Second World Wars. But what happened was Canada clamped down, and the United States followed suit shortly thereafter, pretty much after World War I. And in 1923, there was the Ozawa case, and it was determined by the Supreme Court that they could not hold citizenship. And as a result of that, many of the people that had had citizenship actually had their citizenship revoked, which meant that they were stateless persons. They could stay in the United States as alien residents, but they couldn't leave the United States because they wouldn't be permitted to come back. It was a very difficult situation. And for approximately 45 years, the community was highly encapsulated within the United States. Most of them were on the West Coast, the largest number in California. Okay. Well, it's not that they wanted Indian labor. They actually they were against Indian labor. And well, why don't I run through it? Okay. When the Indians came here, they had had their most experience either in being in the military or as farmers. But initially, there wasn't a great deal of scope of possibility for them to buy land. Obviously, they didn't come with that kind of money. So those that went into farming tended to go into things like small farms in which they would act as farm laborers. They also got immediate employment in things like the mines, and particularly in British Columbia and other parts of Canada, in the logging industry. Many of them worked for the railroads, which were expanding then, and some of them had they had some experience in working on railroads. But basically, it was a fairly itinerant population. Many of them did not read in their own language. Their English language skills might have been somewhat minimal, although if they had been in the army, they would have learned a certain amount of English. And therefore, they came down and took the sorts of jobs they could. The problem was is that about this time, and this happened again and again in Sikh history, that one group would come in, and for example, in California, we first had the Chinese, and then we had the Japanese, and there was a lot of anti-Asian legislation, anti-Oriental legislation, that happened in the United States. And it was particularly virulent in California. So you had anti-Asian laws passed that people couldn't, for example, rent or own property. That was the Alien Exclusion Acts, and a lot of those were done between 1913, 14, 15, partly as a result of World War II, World War I. But that meant that people who wanted to get into other areas of labor couldn't go to places like San Francisco or Los Angeles, where there were large cities, because the unions were very, very much anti-Asian. And so while there were very few Sikhs, they were, those that maintained their turban and beard, highly visible. And so they tended to stay toward the central valleys of California, so the areas in which they could work as migrant farmers or on small ranches. And although a few of them managed to buy land, it was never a sufficient number to lift the whole community basically out of a lower class status. Well, Punjab has probably the highest percentage of owner-operators of small farms in India. And so those that had been on the farm were very highly skilled. And in fact, many of them came to California and were quite valued. They would work on what they called Hindu work gangs. They would come in groups of 10 or 20 people, and they would help to till the fields, and they would help to maintain the orchards and do the irrigation, because in Punjab, one of the things that was very important were the irrigation projects that were very large scale to open up new land in India. And many of them had experience, therefore, in water management. Well, that's an extremely useful and transferable skill to the state of California. And as a consequence, many of them got jobs as irrigators or maintaining the various levees that the farmlands depended upon. So they basically turned their hand to any sort of work that they could get. Often it was in construction or manual labor, but often it was also in agriculture. For those that were in the military, of course, there wasn't too much use for those particular skills here in the United States, and so they often would go back to using their agricultural skills that they brought from India. Well, there were never enough South Asians in the United States to constitute a block of laborers as there were with Chinese, Japanese, and even Filipino. So what you found was that often the Indian work groups were preferred in small numbers, but there was no place where they ever became dependent upon them. There were two centers in California in terms of agriculture that I think were the most important. The first one was down in the Imperial Valley, down around Brawley and Calexico and in those areas around the Salton Sea, because at the time they were expanding and becoming huge sort of factories in the field, sort of commercial agriculture. And a lot of the Sikhs went down there and found that the climate and the winters were very much like they were in Punjab. And they worked down there fairly successfully. But unfortunately, you could never buy enough land down there in order to become an owner. You would have to have several hundred acres and maybe several thousand in order to be economically viable. So what you found over time was that people moved from the Imperial Valley up towards the northern Sacramento Valley around Yuba City and Marysville. And that's where the largest agricultural community outside of India currently resides, is in the Yuba City Marysville area. There are about 10,000, 11,000 Sikhs in that area, most of whom are farmers and often who are very, very successful and own vast tracts of land up there. Probably something like 90% of the clean peach production, canned peaches in the United States, comes from Sikh farms. Well, basically, first of all, the Sikhs were non-Christian. they were seen by the dominant population as non-Caucasian, non-white. They ate strange foods. They spoke a language which was not understood at all. Their English was quite different. And so they were seen as being very, very alien. It was the same sort of response that people had had earlier to Chinese and Japanese. The problem largely for the Sikhs is that they came along essentially at a bad time. They came along when there was a tremendous amount of backlash against Asians in general. So one of the things that they were called, there are many different names, pejorative names, but ragheads was one of them. They also called them the turbaned tide or the turban tribe. And the argument was that, well, okay, there's only a few of them now, but India is a very small country and it is very large and it is very densely populated. And what are we going to do if 400 million people suddenly decide they want to come to the United States? It was an absurd argument based on racism and discrimination, no question. So in a sense, they were probably persecuted far more out of just a sense of principle or non-principle than they were because they constituted any sort of an economic or political threat to the United States. Well, they of course, there were exclusions as early as 1911, 1912 in Los Angeles that said Hindus shouldn't be allowed to own or rent property. That's pretty interesting that it should occur that early. You also find that the alien land laws, of course, applied to them as it applied to everyone else. It wasn't directed at them, but they, as a byproduct of it, they were included in it. By the time the Alien Land Act basically started as a response to World War I, and it was directed at sometimes at Italians, sometimes at Germans. But the idea was that that American property should be owned by Americans, and that meant people who were not immigrants. And as a consequence of that, simply some people were put on that list. So Chinese, Japanese, most people from Asia, and Indians in general, and Sikhs in particular, since they were the largest group that were here, got subsumed under those categories. The first ones were done in Nebraska and in the Midwest, but then very shortly they were brought out and put into place in California. No, that's a really serious problem and something that still bothers the Sikhs to this day. Sikhism is a religion that was founded by Guru Nanak in the late 1600s, late 16th century, late 1500s, and it was basically a kind of a reform religion, and it may be seen by outsiders as having elements of Hinduism and Islam and Christianity. As far as the Sikhs are concerned, it was a new a revealed religion. There were many movements throughout Sikh history of separating themselves out from Hindus. And so they are definitely not Hindus. The problem is that India at that time was also called Hindustan. So to call somebody a Hindu might mean a person from the area of Hindustan, which meant India, not Hinduism, the religion of the majority, 80% of the people of India. At their peak, there probably were never more than 10,000 up until 1947-48. Well, there was an initial flood which probably would have continued, but of course what happened is that very quickly they became socially isolated. They were prosecuted. They were often driven from towns. There were so-called Hindu riots that took place in Washington and Oregon in the early decade of the 1900s, and so I guess that I would say that they were caught up basically in a largely anti-Asian sentiment that went on. And of course, if they maintained the turban and the beard, which are the external symbols of an Orthodox baptized Sikh, then they would be highly visible, which would of course just make them all the more a target. Well, there are several ways. First of all, most of the people that came did not come individually. That is, they would come with several people from their village, or at least a few people from the area. They would often sometimes come with another relative, an uncle or a nephew, that sort of thing. And so they tended to live together, they tended to cook together, they tended to work together. So in that case, they formed a sort of encapsulated self-perpetuating self-referential community for a very long period of time, like many immigrant groups. In addition to that, they have a very strong faith, and I think a lot of them turn to that, basically saying that they needed to endure this, that they were doing it for their families, they were doing it for the money that they could send back, very much like many migrants do today. But also there was a second element to that, and that is early in the 1900s and increasing in the period up to 1920, 1930, you had a certain group, about 400 Sikhs married into the Hispanic community. And their offspring were, of course, half a Mexican and what was called then half Hindu, and so it's a group that actually constituted, they were called the Mexidus, and they have still, many people today are descendants of them, and they see themselves as having a very proud part of that heritage. Of course, what would have happened if India had not opened up is that this community might have become more established and married amongst themselves, but they didn't, and as soon as people started to come from India, this community then, first of all, became smaller in number, and then they become overwhelmed by the newcomers, the new Sikhs, and then in some ways, rather sadly, some of the things that they did, some of the practices were rejected by the Sikhs that were coming in, and so there occurred a sort of estrangement between these groups that were, raised part in the Mexican culture, part in the Hindu culture. Interestingly enough, many of the women raised their children in the Catholic Church, and it was not unusual for them to have comadres and copadres, that is, godparents, the man of whom would be Sikh and the woman of whom would be Mexican, within the rituals of the Catholic Church. So you had the compadrazgo system, or the godparent system, operating with both Punjabis and Mexican American families. Sometimes they were Mexican from Mexico, sometimes they were Mexican American families, but it was largely to Hispanics. And often they would marry sisters. Well, one Sikh would meet a woman and he would marry her, and then he'd say, "I have a friend," or "I have a cousin," and a nice girl. And she said, "Well, my sister." And so you found that there were many, many what would you call it, marriages of proximity that took place. There were some cultural similarities. I think you could go too far with them sometimes, but basically you had groups that were on the lower socioeconomic status. You had groups that had been discriminated against, that had a slightly darker skin color, the foods actually were interesting, because Mexican food and Indian food, on some levels, the difference between a roti and a chapati is not a great deal. And they both liked prepared chicken, they're found a lot of cultural similarities, very strong family ties, very much importance with family honor and with tradition. And since you have to remember that the Sikhs at this time, most of them could not leave the country and come back. And in some cases, they even had wives back home, but the possibility of them going back to India and being reunited was an impossibility for a period of about 35 years. And so many of the Sikhs decided to get married here, even though they had a family in India. It was simply, yes, they came over as male work groups, essentially. There were no more than half a dozen women on the West Coast for the entire first 50 years in the 20th century. And they did not expect to get stuck here. They expected to be able to go home or establish a home and bring their families over. This did not happen for, 95% of the Sikhs that came over. They had to be reunited with their families after the independence of India in 1947, when India was given independence. Mm-hmm. Dilip Singh, what's the name again? I am not familiar with that case. Well, I believe that was probably fairly early, 1907, 1908, 1909, when people realized that it was going to become increasingly difficult to go back, or they simply wanted to be able to have the ability to have to own land and to to participate in the society in a larger way. There were several hundred that eventually were able to get citizenship, but many of those were rescinded in the 1923 case. Citizenship had been denied to a number of groups, but it was very often partly dependent on what jurisdiction you were in. What happened, though, between 1900 and it's probably started as late as early in the, as the 1880s, but by the 1920s, there was a fairly negative feeling in general about immigration to the United States from Asia. And the first case in which this did deny citizenship to a group of people was the Ozawa case, in which it was determined by the Supreme Court that Japanese were not entitled to or eligible for U.S. citizens because they were not Caucasian. And on the basis of that decision, there was a gentleman named Bhagat Singh Tind, who was a Sikh, who had served in the army in World War I, and he took the case to the Supreme Court, that saying that the Indians, at least those in North India, those speaking Indo-European languages, were actually descendants of the original Aryans from Europe. That is, they were ethnologically speaking, biologically speaking, Europeans or Caucasians. And what was so telling about that decision that was made by Justice Sutherland is the decision came down against them, saying that they were ineligible for citizenship, not because they might not be racially or ethnically Caucasians. That wasn't the argument. The argument was they weren't white people in the normal sense of the word, of the idea of the average man on the street. So it was pretty clear that that was an overtly racist, and that their intention was to remove Asians in general, but Indians in particular, and in this case Sikhs, although it wasn't aimed specifically at Sikhs, it impacted upon them much more greatly, because there were more of them here. So all Indians were rendered ineligible for citizenship. And as I said before, there were many who had their citizenship at that time basically revoked and taken back in 1924. Well, they couldn't own land. They couldn't vote. They had none of the normal protections that a U.S. citizen would. They couldn't leave the country. They weren't issued a passport, so they couldn't travel. Basically, what happened is they were kind of encapsulated. And what happened is the ways they got around that sort of thing was to put land, if they had any, in the names of their children, their U.S.-born children that had been born in the United States, or their Mexican-American wives, so that they would actually shield it by putting it in the names of people that had either citizenship from another source that is independent of theirs, or had children that were born in the United States and therefore were considered U.S. citizens. Oh, absolutely. Many of them had fought for the British. As many of them had fought for the United States, and they thought, why are they doing this? And another element, of course, was that the British government did not intervene on behalf of the Sikhs that were in the United States, or for that matter, in Canada. And it just basically showed the position that India was a colonial power, and that Great Britain and the United States basically did not have their interests at heart. And it just made it all the more poignant and all the more upsetting. That their own government, or what they saw that should have been their government intervening on their behalf, did nothing to prevent any of these things from occurring. Well, before that, many of them did not apply for citizenship, and therefore they just remained, many of them illegal, as I said before. But those that came in basically had, the usual immigrant status, foreign residency status. But what the Bhagat Singh Thind said was, if you had it, we're taking it away, and if you didn't have it, you're now ineligible for it. So prior to that, you could have been eligible for it. In fact, Bhagat Singh Thind had citizenship. He was basically doing this on behalf of other people. And so, the idea was, regardless of what the specifics were of the immigration laws, the overall emphasis was, for a period of about 30 years, to stop immigration as much as possible from areas of the world which were considered to be undesirable. Well, if they were in a position where they could buy land, and they could hold it in their own name, they would have legal protections of the courts. They would have legal protections. They could sign contracts. They would have all of the advantages of anyone who was a citizen. They could, if they wished, sue somebody, have the government, take a look at something that they felt was unjust. In other words, there was some recourse. They had a legal standing. And once you take that away, then it becomes much more difficult for people to assert their rights. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay, the Gadar movement, the word Gadar means mutiny in Hindi, or Punjabi, excuse me. And it was started by a professor at an Indian professor, Hardayal, at Stanford. And it basically was a movement that was hopefully to overthrow the British government. It was located in the United States, in California. The majority of its members that eventually joined it and supported it, both financially and as activists, were the Sikh farmers of California. And this was one of the responses to the discrimination and the negative social climate in the United States, and the fact that Britain was doing nothing to alleviate that. So that they joined, obviously, there were other movements that had begun before this in terms of the independence movement, and Gandhi, of course, once he returned from South Africa to India, this was a very strong movement. The Indian National Congress started in 1880, and you had lots of anti-British movements begin in India from that time forward. In the United States, this basically, what they said was, we will try to subvert the colonial rule in any way that we can and support anyone in India who is against the British rule. So the Gadar movement started out as a kind of a sort of a group divided up into these small cells, and they would publish newspapers in Urdu and Hindi and Punjabi and English, and they would try to raise money to send back to India. They would harbor people that were perhaps wanted in India who had fled to Canada or to the United States. And the Gadar movement basically was a revolutionary movement. Its major impact was between about 1913 and about 1917, 1918, because what happened is one of the things that they did was they got involved. They had agents that they sent all over the world, Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, even to China and to Russia and to Germany. And there was a conspiracy trial that was held in San Francisco during which one of the major people in the trial was shot to death. And what happened is, unfortunately, that tie that was made between Germany, who had just lost World War I, and the Gadar movement was very damaging to it. But the Gadar movement itself lived on, and it actually lived on into independence. It was never particularly effective after that, but it was basically a California-based international freedom-seeking revolutionary movement, and it was very strongly supported by Sikhs in the Central Valley. They were the primary financial supporters. They actually, a group of them actually went back on a ship to India and with the intention of joining people who were actively fighting against the British, and they were basically informed upon, and shortly after they arrived, many of them were arrested, and some of them were deported for life, some of them were incarcerated for long periods of time, and in a few cases, some of them were executed. No. Militarily, they were of no consequence at all. Well, yes, I think, number one, they gave people a sense that they could fight against injustice, that they could support. You have to remember that all these people still had relatives back in Punjab or somewhere in India, and therefore these people were living under colonial rule that many of them felt was deeply unjust. And the reason they had come to this conclusion was they had had a British education. And so it was interesting that the British are talking about human rights and representation under law, and yet India was seeing that this was not the case for Indians. And so I think that the Gadar movement was probably a very good psychological boost that they were actually trying to do something, and that they would, you know, since they couldn't improve their status here through revolution, that would certainly not work. They were trying to do it, in a sense, at a distance and to assist the people in India. When their understanding was that if the Indian government, if the British could be driven out and the Indians could take over India, that their position would be better off all over the world, wherever Indians were, because then the national government would look after them as their citizens. Yes, and anybody who came here had been a British subject. Well, they would be if they stayed in Canada. Of course, if they came here, then they would be on a Commonwealth, they would have probably been on a Commonwealth passport. To be honest with you, the whatever status that they had didn't matter much, in the sense that whatever their status was elsewhere, once they got here, certainly after the first 20 years of the presence, actually not quite that much, about the first 16 years of the presence, they essentially were reduced to having almost no rights whatsoever. Well, 1923 put the final that loss of citizenship, and basically, of course, they had stopped immigration. There was no substantial immigration after 1908. So for practical purposes, the big number of people came to the United States in only a four-year period in the first half of the first decade of the 1900s. And so, as you can see, the community itself was destined from the very beginning to diminish over time. And in fact, by 1945, 1946, there probably weren't more than about 1,500 Sikhs left in the United States, and most of those were in and around Northern California. Well, the British made it much more difficult. They also feared that there would be large numbers of Indians coming into Canada, regardless of the fact that they had Commonwealth status, and therefore they started campaigns that were very similar to the campaigns that happened later in Canada with the idea of White Canada. In other words, the idea was to restrict the immigration to people that came from Northern Europe or from Australia or from England or, you know, some other place. Rather than from India or from the Commonwealth. And so they restricted immigration also in Canada, not allowing other people to come. There was a major difference in Canada, however, is that relatively early on, they allowed for some reunification of families. So it was possible for some of these Punjabi families to have their family, sometimes their parents, their wives and children, to join them in Canada, although they were not allowed to have other large numbers come. So there was a little bit of a possibility of having a normal life in Canada, but in the very beginning, in that first decade, basically immigration was closed down fairly substantially by both Canada and the United States, and for the same reasons. Right, yes. There were one or two people that brought wives, but that was it. They simply couldn't afford it. It was very expensive, and it took a very long time at that time to get to the west coast of the United States. I would guess that probably would be the equivalent of $1,000 now, which is a you know, great deal of money. Well, I think that they were under the radar, that they weren't very many of them, that they were not coming in large groups to do this, they were allowed to, they basically, it seems, kept under the radar. You find a similar situation with miscegenation laws, of laws against people marrying other people. Those were still very common in the United States, and they were on the books in California. So when you had, in the beginning, you had some of these marriages that were starting to occur between the Sikhs and the Mexican-American community. And what would happen is they would go to a jurisdiction, let's say in Brawley or Calexico, and they would try to get a marriage license, and someone would say, you can't get a marriage license because this person's Mexican and you're not white. And so they would say, yes, but I'm a Sikh, I'm a Caucasian. They say, forget it. Well, for a while they could go to a place like San Francisco or a place like Los Angeles where people didn't care that much and occasionally get their licenses. But then after a while, that began to be a problem. And so sometimes they used very creative means to get around this. The one I love the most was sometime in the mid-teens, a man took his wife to San Diego, or took his intended bride to San Diego because he'd been refused a license in El Centro, and he was refused a license in Los Angeles, I believe. And what he did was he hired a tugboat captain who could perform marriages to go out beyond the 12-mile limit and perform the ceremony at sea, and came back and registered himself as being married. So there were lots of kind of ways in which you would call these sort of rituals of rebellion or rituals of where people who are really being oppressed in some way figure out ways to sort of use the system and make it work for them. I think that the citizenship issue was that there weren't that many of them, and so sometimes they would grant it and sometimes they wouldn't. For example, if you had military service, you were allowed automatically to apply. No, U.S. military service in World War I. But I'm not an expert in the legal stuff. I mean, you're getting into areas which is way beyond my interest. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was in a bar outside of Marysville on a Saturday afternoon, and a drunk white man came out of the bar. He called him a gora, which is a term in Punjabi for a white person, and he was drunk and came up to him and said, "You're a slave." And he said, "What do you mean I'm a slave?" He said, "Well, India is run by the British, and America is run by the Americans, and so, you know, you're a slave." I'm not sure that this were the words the man actually used, but this is the, as he told me, you know, 30 years later after this had occurred. And so he just hit him, and then he ran away. But this was a very important thing in his life, because what it said to him was the country that he came from was not free. And that as long as the country he came from was not free, then even if he was in America, he also wasn't free, because he wasn't free under American law and he wasn't free under British law. And therefore, he was very resentful of this because, of course, from his perspective, it was the Indians who had the right to govern and make the rules in India. There were many other people that had similar instances where people would basically say, you know, you're a subjugated people, you're a colonial group, you're run by, it's the Europeans that are running your country. I was interviewing some of the oldest men. I did 2 years of research in the Yuba City, Marysville area, and some of the people that had been there from the earliest days were by this time in their 60s and 70s. And I interviewed them, and I have several hundred hours of interviews, and these were some of the ones that really stuck out in my own mind as being important, because the same person that said this was also a strong supporter for many years of the gutter movement. And so my own feeling is joining the gutter movement was a way to counteract, to do something positive to take action against what he saw as, this negative position that Indians were held by other people. The reality is the 1917 barred zone provision basically did not impact the Indians, except in this sense. It made it impossible for people to immigrate. But for practical purposes, since 1908, 1909, there hadn't been any immigrations or large-scale immigrations. You know, a few dozen or maybe a few hundred would come in, but often this would be illegally. So it almost didn't matter. The 1917 barred zone provision had greater impacts in other countries than it did on India. In a way, all it did was codify what had already happened, which was the cutoff of immigration from India. Mm-hmm. Well, you'd get off, go through immigration. If your papers were okay, you'd be allowed in or given immigrant status, foreign status, resident status. And then if you want to, you just, of course, walk across the border and never report yourself to anybody again if you didn't want to in the United States. If you weren't trying to do anything legal, that is to buy land or to... go to court or anything like that, then the chances were that, people would just leave you alone and you'd do your work and you'd get paid and you income tax and withholding wasn't the same back then. And so you could work for cash and could be completely off the economy. And lots of people did that, certainly during the Depression. Lots of Americans did that. They would come through Mexico. And this was mostly illegals. This was after about 1910, 1912. Most of the illegals started to come in later after the barred zone provision. So probably these 3,000 came over a period of about maybe 15 years, most of them through Mexico. Okay. Legally? Well, legally, there wasn't a great deal of mechanism to do it. But what would happen is people would come into a town, they'd start to camp out, and then the people would come along and say, "You can't stay here," and they'd beat them up and they'd drive them out of town. I mean, it was at the most basic sort of level in which they would be, driven from place to place because they were considered undesirable. It didn't happen to everyone. But it happened to a fairly large number of them. And as I say, that was a byproduct of a sort of pervasive anti-Oriental discrimination that had begun with the Chinese immigration, many, many decades before. Right. Uh-huh. Well, there are several communities. The community that was probably affected the most deeply would have been the single men who did not marry, because those people would then be attached to ranches or would be working at menial labor, and their lives were very hard and very difficult. They never got very much money, never owned land, never were able to send very much home. So from their perspective, the movement to the United States was really a disaster. For those who married into the sub-communities, of the subgroups, like Mexican Americans, they had fairly rich and good family lives. They had intact families. They both believed very much, they're monotheistic, right? Both Sikhs and Christians, particularly Catholics, believe in a single God, monotheistic God. They believed in hard work, and both communities were very hardworking. They both loved children, adored children, both males and females. And as a consequence, those who could settle down and have some sort of home life, it was not a bad place. They were in rural areas. During the Depression, for example, they had access to milk from cows and crops that they would grow from their gardens. And it was much easier to be in a rural area in California if you were settled and had been there for a while than it was for the migrants who came in later, like the people, the Okies and the Arkies, who came out of the areas of the United States that were being devastated by the Dust Bowl. So many of these families talked about these times as, yes, we were poor, but we didn't know it. We were not unhappy. We had enough to eat. We had clothes on our backs. We had a place to live on a farm, and it was not a bad life. If you did not have that kind of social network, then it was really hard indeed, because you were encapsulated, and probably most of your friends or your only friends were other Punjabis. Yeah, I mean, it was an aging population, and the population dwindled from something like 9 to 10,000 to about 1,500, 1,400 by 1947. So if India had not become independent, if immigration had not resumed, it's very likely that when those last people that had come directly from India died out, that all that would be left, in a sense, would be the offspring of the Sikhs and the Mexican wives. In other words, it would be a biracial community that would be left as the only sort of social remnant of Sikh presence in the United States. Well, it's very interesting. You would expect that there would be a tremendous movement both ways. And the reality was there wasn't. After 1947, between 1947 and 1965, there was very little growth in the Indian community in the United States. There were some of the people that after independence, they went back to their villages. Some of them didn't come back to the United States. They retired in India. Others went back. And of course, by this time, many times their parents had died. Perhaps family members they had back there had all grown up, and so they weren't interested in coming back to the United States. In a few cases, people brought relatives to the United States, but the numbers were in the hundreds, not any more than that. And it wasn't until one of the reasons was that when they opened up the immigration to India, they set a limit on the number of people who could come from India at something like 400 or 500 a year. In other words, for a country that had 400, 450 million people, it was an absurdly small number. It was almost kind of insulting. I mean, you could be a citizen now. Yes, you could do that. But when it came to actually how many people could immigrate, the number was exceedingly small. That was changed in 1967 under some legislation that had started with President Kennedy and was signed by President Johnson, that basically redid the immigration laws. And that started a movement by 1968, 69, 70 of a reconstitution in the United States. And of course, hundreds of thousands of South Asians have come into the United States since then. And the population now of Indians in the United States is over a million. 65. Yes, the people that had been denied their those that had immigration status as citizens and had their citizenship papers, they were told that they could reapply and that those would be reinstated. But there's a very interesting story connected to that. There were several older men who at that time, I had lived in the United States now for 35 or 40 years, and they said, I applied once, I was given my citizenship, and then it was taken away from me. And if I can get my original citizenship restored, I'll accept it. If I can't, I'm not reapplying. In other words, their original papers, in other words, rather than having to reapply and be issued a new status, they said, I did it right once and you took it away. I want you to restore it in its original form. It's just a matter of pride, that's all. Many of them did, and they did get their citizenship restored. And, of course, anybody that wanted to at that time could apply for citizenship if they chose to. Some people did and some people didn't. Some people stayed in the United States until they died, and they were still not citizens. Well, India. Well, it does, because India was one of our major allies in the war in Asia, and as was Great Britain. And, of course, in the fight for Burma and in the fight for all of Southeast Asia, India played a major role. And, of course, the Sikhs were a major part of the Indian armed forces. So I think it was in recognition of the role that the Allies had played, and India in particular, as a supporter during World War II. In both world wars, yes. Well, many of them had citizenship. Bhagat Singh Thind, for example, it was in First World War, had citizenship. He was the person that the citizenship was then taken away after World War I. In World War II, people came on British passports, and some of them were able to join the armed forces, and some of them, you know, if you're a foreign born, you can join the armed forces. There are many people serving in Iraq right now who are not U.S. citizens. Yeah. You mean in our military? Oh, minuscule. A handful at best. I mean, it's not a big factor. Well, I'm not sure that there is. I'm not sure there's a great untold story, except that the entire story itself is untold. If you go to Indian communities today, particularly non-Sikh communities, and you ask them, what happened, when were the first people that came here, and what were the situations and what were the circumstances under which they lived, very often they have very little idea. This is a whole part of their own history, which I think is a very kind of valiant part, because these people came here under extremely difficult circumstances. They had to work very hard. They often got very few rewards, and yet they stuck it out, and many of them did thrive. And in the new community here, as you know, many doctors, engineers, lawyers are Sikhs. It's a very big professional community, and in fact, Sikhs have the highest per capita income of all Asian groups in the United States, and they also have the highest education levels of post high school for secondary as well as graduate education. So it has gone from a community that was extremely disenfranchised to an elite community now that is, you know, sometimes looked at as a model minority, but certainly one of the most successful Asian groups in the United States. And it's that story that these are the same people, just operating under different sets of rules, operating under different restrictions, operating under different social realities. And they did, but I think that it was sort of the core values of hard work, of responsibility, of saving, of a desire to own land, of strong family values that really allowed them to survive under the circumstances that they did. The education levels obviously are different. It was fairly low. Average number of school years completed for the South Asians that remained in Yuba City, Marysville, a study that was done of about 400, was about 3.7 years of formal schooling. This would have been in 1947. Many of them couldn't read in their own language. Yes. Well, I guess it's shockingly blatant when the Justice Sutherland, who is the head of the Supreme Court, comes out and says, "Well, yes, they are technically white people, but that not in the common person's understanding of the term." I don't know if you can get much more blatant than that. Racist. Discriminatory. Okay. Okay. I'm Bruce LeBrack. Professor of Anthropology and International Studies at the University of the Pacific in California, and I have been observing and participating in and celebrating Sikhs in the United States for the last 30 years. No. Shanty Irish and French Basque for my background. Yeah, very, very much so. Okay, and if you need any, am I going to get a chance to hear this before it goes? Okay, I just like to make sure that all the material facts are correct, dates and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Hi, Michael. We're leaving. Okay. Bye, bye. Wow, she was into the immigration thing. She wanted to know all these really specific things. I don't think that...
Okay, Slate, this is a room tone in Professor LeBrack's office on the 15th of April, starting now.